Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, religious studies professor Dr. Katie Kurtz discusses her book, Assembling Religion, The Ford Motor Company and the Transformation of Religion in America. This conversation originally took place March 5th, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to this program at the American Writers Museum. I'm Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the AWM. If you like the kinds of programs that you're seeing here at the AWM, you can join us as a member by going to AmericanWritersMuseum.org or by signing up at the kiosk near our front desk. You get free museum admission as well as advance access to events and programs, including our Biennial Writers Festival, which returns this June. Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Tonight's program is offered in conjunction with our newest exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which looks at the ways in which religion and spirituality have affected American writers' work and how that work has in turn affected the practice and perception of religion in this country. In her new religious history, Dr. Katie Kurtz, associate professor in the Department of Religious Studies at Sewanee, the University of the South, looks at the ways in which manufacturing and technology intersect with American religious practice. As a member of the Episcopal Church, reader of New Thought texts, believer in the gospel of reincarnation, mass marketer of anti-Semitic material, and employer who institutionalized a social gospel, Henry Ford's contributions to the American model of business were informed by and produced for an American America he understood to be broadly Christian. Through Ford's efforts at the head of the Ford Motor Company have been commonly been understood as secular, Ford himself was explicit that his work in engineering and auto production was prophetic and intended to remake the world. Dr. Kurtz is here with us to discuss her book, Assembling Religion. Please join me in welcoming her to the AWM. Well, thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about how you begin this book. So you talk a little bit about Henry Ford's personal religious background, his growing up in the Episcopal Church. How did that, tell us a little bit about that background and how it shaped his life.
Yeah, well, thank you guys. I want to say more directly, thank you guys for coming, for giving some of your time, and for being ready to think with me about Ford and religion. It seems like a weird connection. So, but yeah, one of the kind of obvious connections between these two is Henry Ford's own sort of church history. He is professed and confessed Episcopalian. His family came from Ireland, Protestant Irish, and settled in the kind of Dearborn, Detroit area. And he grew up going, kind of being a part of the Episcopal Church, and had kind of other influences. His father was a member of the Masons, so had this kind of Freemasonry connection that many industrialists do too. And so that was also part of this. And the Ford family attended the Episcopal Cathedral in Detroit, and it's the dean of the Episcopal Cathedral at the time, Samuel Marquis. I never know if that's the right way to say his name. It's spelled Marquis, like kind of the French spelling, but I'm a reader and author, like, we, you know, sometimes we don't exactly know how to say it. So I think it's Marquis, though. Marquis was the pastor there, and he ends up being an executive at the Ford Motor Company. So these Episcopal connections are quite strong through Ford's life.
Yeah. He, as an engineer, as an inventor, he saw himself as doing prophetic work. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, you know, that mindset and how that expressed itself in his work.
Yeah, this is, you know, he brazenly asserts this in an interview in Good Housekeeping with Reverend William Stidger, also a kind of firebrand figure. And he says to him, like, Isaiah, if Isaiah was here today, he wouldn't be writing. We're in the Writers Museum. He wouldn't be writing. He'd be looking at blueprints, remaking the world instead of writing about it. So Ford really understood engineering as this like capacious category, and understood it as a kind of prophetic practice, one that, you know, he figured himself this latter-day Isaiah to re-engineer the whole world. He may have.
Was his focus really on that big of a picture in the beginning, or did it develop as he went about his work?
Hard to say, actually. I mean, because the book doesn't trace a kind of, I don't know, intellectual history of Henry Ford, the figure, I don't know the answer to that. He is, though, even early on, a thinker of immensity, you know, scaling up everything. You know, the assembly line is something that other in other places are using, but he's going to do it the biggest and the best, you know. So that kind of big business is also, you know, contextually part of this era. Good business is big business in this period. And so, you know, he does think of big business, and there's language here. He directly says, big business is sacred. This is something, when you're responsible for that many people, that is a kind of holy trust. And that's his language too. So I think that kind of big scale was at least significant. I don't know if I could trace a change over time or not.
Yeah. He really seemed to see himself as a paternal figure in the godlike sense of, as you said, I'm responsible for all of these souls. Mm-hmm. How did that reflect in the way he conducted his business and his management? What did he do with his employees to sort of standardize and industrialize that?
Yeah, this language of paternalism is one that is wielded against Ford at the time. Like, contemporaries are critiquing him as a kind of paternalist figure. Ford and his executives would counter over and over again that we are not paternal, we are fraternal. And they have a whole language about fraternity and fraternalism, slogans about helping the other fellow, imagining themselves and really conceiving of or promoting a conception of corporate relations as what they talk about as partnership, as if corporate and that capital and labor are going to be partners in this practice. And they promote their labor policies and wage changes accordingly. And most famously, this comes out in what gets known in the press as the Ford $5 day, really famous kind of like marker of Fordism is this $5 day moment in Ford Motor Company history, which is to say that all workers were going to get paid high wages. So the going rate at the time was $2 and maybe, I don't know, change. And they changed it to, they increased it by over twice the going rate, that all workers, regardless of skill or experience. So now this is not like only available to highly skilled workers, but all workers could earn $5 a day, which is very high at the time. Historians continue to debate how high that really was as we move on. But so this idea that you would, you know, pay workers high wages and then they would wager for you, they would be your partners. Then, you know, that was kind of in the press popularly. It was called a kind of profit sharing plan is what they called it. Like, we're not going to issue dividends. We're instead going to raise wages, and our workers are the people who are going to benefit. And that's why they called it a profit sharing plan. The reality is that workers, in order to be eligible for the $5 day, were then subjected to really intense oversight. They implemented what was known as the sociological department. It goes by many names: sociological department, social welfare department, the welfare department, a very kind of early personnel department, or even what we think of now as HR, human resources. And this sociological department hired, and this is also the department that Ford's personal minister comes to head up. And this department is in charge of sort of overseeing, implementing and overseeing the $5 day. And in the process, what they do is, in order to be eligible for this high wage, you have to adhere to these sort of standards of cleanliness and citizenship. This is the language that they use. In practice, what it means is they hire all these investigators who then go out into workers' homes and make sure they are following a set of standards that Ford sets up about hygiene, about domestic cleanliness, not allowing for boarders. So like many people at the time, in order to make additional money, they would, you know, rent out, let out rooms. Ford hated this project. The boarding room is not a great thing, he says. And they surveilled workers' bank accounts. They privileged married men. And so many, the worry was that people would say they were married and they weren't. So then they would like go in their family Bibles. They would interview neighbors. It was a really rigorous system of surveillance. So many people, I think even, you know, I think historians and, but, you know, workers at the time experienced this as paternalism. Ford corporate says, this is fraternalism. We are trying to help you. And this is the right way to help. This is what they called the Ford idea of welfare.
Well, and that sort of scrutiny and that kind of instruction fell really heavily on immigrant workers who Ford welcomed, but then, you know, would say, oh, well, you can't live here. You have to, in a boarding house, you need to live in a single family home, or you need to, and your wife shouldn't work, and you shouldn't save all of your money. There's that great story in your book about the folks who were saving money, and he, you know, essentially convinced them to spend it instead.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So the majority of Ford workers at this time are immigrants. And so, you know, this oversight is, you know, largely of an immigrant workforce. And yeah, so there's many things. So one of the things that they, you know, Ford says, like, in America, we aren't miserly. The point is to invest in yourself. and that you should, you know, buy good furniture. And so, like, sociological department investigators would go shopping with people and, like, say, like, you got to go buy this stuff. And then they would move them out. And so there are these stories. The sociological department investigators compile all of this information on these forms. And then they made this kind of testimony book, which many of which survive. And so we have these stories from these investigators who are like, you know, one of them is, and some of them get published in Ford imprints, corporate imprints. And so we have these stories of certain workers who are like, you know, they were, you know, penny pinching, and the wife was run ragged, and the kids were running wild. And after, you know, being taught by these investigators, they now smile and thank Ford for, so there are these very common tropes across these testimonies. The other thing that falls on immigrant workers at this time is a campaign of Americanization that is run also through the sociological department and becomes central to the work that it does through its English school. So all immigrant workers at the time were required to attend this English school. And the Ford English School had a very robust curriculum. They taught English. They also taught etiquette and manners and dinner, I don't know, table things. And then after you made it through, you went through a graduation ceremony that is, I mean, I'm happy to talk about, but it is quite a thing. and
the cauldron.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I can say more about that. But one of the things I wanted to just mention is that once you graduated from the Ford English school, this, it was so influential that it became a way to mark the first step in U.S. naturalization. And the Ford English School becomes a model for other civic programs of teaching English and municipal English programs and a national Americanization campaign. And a Ford graduate certificate counted as the first step in that naturalization process. So it was extremely influential, not just to the workers,
yeah,
but to Americans across the country. I mean, to immigrant Americans across the country.
It's really obvious once you get into the book and once, you know, and listening to you describe it, the parallels to a religious system are really obvious, that this was, you know, this is not a company town, but it's a company way of life. And, you know, and so this was, you know, there was indoctrination, there was, you know, the compact between the worker and, you know, their employer. And you tied it a little bit, I think, to prosperity gospel that we hear today, the idea that working and earning are sacred duties, and you don't necessarily need to feel guilty about the time that you spend doing them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, Ford is pretty explicit in his own kind of prophetic practice, and not just as a kind of engineer, but as a kind of, in the study of religion, one of the people we turn to try to think about prophecy is this guy named Max Weber, a theorist of religion a sociologist of religion, who theorized prophecy as this way of systematizing in it all areas of life. And I think if you are drawing on that kind of idea about prophecy, Ford certainly fits the bill. And he understood himself to be too. So yeah, this idea that hard work, or maybe not hard work, but consistent work, labor, is something that is sacred, is something Ford promoted directly. The idea that work was salvific was central to Ford's own ideas about right religiosity. And here, I mean, he's quite explicit here. There is, he says, no distinction between the material and the spiritual realms of life, and that work is his gospel. It is what will right the human, you know, and here I really read him as a kind of ritual theorist offering a kind of ritual theory of labor. That what is the difference between labor and ritual? Well, Ford says they're one and the same, and we can right ourselves through the labor we engage in. And here he differs from his own pastor and others, I think.
Yeah. And some of those impulses to improve people, to improve society, led him to some ideas that we now broadly recognize as harmful. So the eugenics and his anti-Semitic views. Tell us a little bit about that and how that affected how he saw the world.
Yeah, I mean, Ford really does understand himself as engineering society, as an engineer, as a prophet. He's going to remake the world. And so, you know, I love my job, but I don't know if I want it to be salvific. Ford, though, really sees right action as evident of old souls. Here, Ford is drawing on social Darwinist ideas, this idea that, you know, we think of like Darwin and his, Darwin's ideas of evolution that then get applied to all society, a kind of Lamarckian or Herbert Spencer idea of evolution, that some societies are more evolved than others, right? And Ford really buys into this racial science of the time, and that some people, some societies are more advanced than others. I haven't mentioned this, but he's a really professed believer in reincarnation. And part of what is so compelling to Ford about reincarnation is that it gives a system for all life that is more complete, right? People who have more like him must have acquired over time. And that this is one of the ways we can see that, that these old, so he talks about like Jesus as an old soul. Also Edison, Thomas Edison, he's BFFs with, and really loves Edison, and he's also an old soul. And so these ideas about sort of social Darwinism that he systematizes in both his ideas about reincarnation also relate to and kind of stand in contrast to his ideas about some human differences that cannot be rightly incorporated. And so here, the figure of, for Ford, this figure called the International Jew, a fiction he makes up, right, and draws from notorious forgeries like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a notorious forgery that then he publishes as, well, what he says is the neglected truth, and sort of stands in contrast to the more advanced form of human productivity, which he terms the American pioneer. And really helps systematize a whole historical industry around.
I was just going to ask, you alluded a moment ago to the Ford imprints. Talk a little bit about how he externalized all of this beyond just, although there were thousands of his factory workers, but larger than that, he was speaking to a much, much larger audience than just his workers. How did he do that?
I mean, the workers are enormous, right? There's Ford factories on six continents very early on. So there is, it's a huge empire just there, right? And you're quite right. Ford is a mass mediator too, not just producing cars, but producing a huge array of media forms. So publishing books, he has multiple autobiographies, publishing a newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, which is where he most notoriously features his anti-Semitic statements, and is also, I was surprised by this as I was doing research, but is also the largest producer of motion picture early in the 20th century, is the one of the first in-house photography and film departments, and scales up its production very quickly. So they are sharing newsreels, weekly newsreels that are being shown around the country for free. They're distributing them to theaters all around the country, silent films, right? And they're not just industrial films about what's happening in the plants. They're all kinds of films. Newsreels, you know, they produce a set of educational materials. There's one that I analyze in the book about democracy in education and really kind of thinking about like what is right democracy in America in contrast here to really in contrast to like native peoples who he sees as kind of stagnant and not forward moving. So here we also see other kinds of racial forms that he helps standardize in this era.
Yeah. So he's really reaching beyond just the automotive realm, the industrial realm.
Absolutely.
He is setting himself up as an arbiter of truth across the country on any number of different subjects.
That's right.
What kind of pushback is he getting from his contemporaries at this point?
A lot. I mean, not as much early on.
Yeah.
So even, you know, kind of union organizers early on are strangely delighted by the $5 day, are sort of like, we've been pushing for all these things, like finally the 8-hour day, right? Like, which he implements as part of the $5 day program. You know, it serves his interests certainly to do that. They now have three shifts instead of two, for example. So early on, some of those criticisms seem more muted, but over time, they become quite loud. And certainly we see this happening directly with unions some of the most brutal crackdown of unions in the Ford plants. And here, Ford is notorious for this. Major campaigns against Ford happen at the Ford plant, a really well-known battle of the overpass in 1937, where people are harmed. And so there, you know, there's a lot of critique there. Some his competitors are critiquing him in a strange way, kind of. Some of them accuse him of being a socialist for his $5 day, for example. So yeah, there's a lot of pushback. And part of what I wanted to explore in the book is, even amid significant criticism of Ford, you know, he is in the press, he's deemed the Mussolini of Highland Park, right? These are not small words. He is understood to be a dangerous fascist of the era. And it is surprising what Americans consent to. And I think trying to recognize and wrestle with that reality is part of what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the contemporary echoes of, you know, what are the lessons of this time and of his actions that we still are learning today?
Yeah, I like this question. And I mean, it's one that I mentioned this before we were here. One of the things that I am eager to understand from people who read the book is the resonances that other people see. But, you know, much of what I was reading in the archives resonated in our own moment in this way that I was like, we all think we're post-Fordist, but I'm not so sure. Like, ideas about engineers as remaking the world, you know, is really resonant when I think about, you know, maybe a motor car company isn't how we imagine that today, but certainly the men, and I do kind of mean men, of Silicon Valley have ideas about remaking the world and making it a better place. Ford talked about machinery as a new messiah that would do what no one else could ever do, right? It was going to free up contemplative power. I see resonances in conversations about generative AI and, the cryogenic crowd and, right, the long-termists. I think all of these are echoes of, I think Ford is an ancestor to them. You know, I can say more about some of the, you know, in our own political discourse, see people talking about the importance of labor, of work. I think about the ways that the most recent, HB1, the Big Beautiful Bill, re-implemented work requirements for government assistance, right? These kinds of ideas about what work does and the value of work for people, I think, remains with us, you know, as we think about what it means to labor. These are things I think we still see today.
Yeah. Well, and like we talked about earlier, the prosperity gospel and the idea that wealth is godly for some people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you know, Ford, again, he really thinks there. So it might seem like when I talk about Ford, it might seem like the stuff about reincarnation or him being an Episcopal are the religious stuff about Ford. But Ford really says, like, there's no difference between material and physical. So what I'm doing in the machinery in my plant is spiritual. And so this, and he really thinks, like, religion that ignores what he calls bread and butter issues is wrong. And here is where I really see him as being a kind of prosperity gospel. Not, you know, it is not just about working and laboring, but it is about right religion is about fulfilling material needs. And that's fascinating, because this is a person who really understood, like, the consecration of business as his prosperity gospel for people. Like, I am gifting you the chance to be prosperous.
And that really, I mean, you can kind of see where the socialist accusations come in there, because if you're not storing up treasure in heaven, if you're not waiting for your, if you're allowed to take your earthly reward while you're still on earth, what are you worshiping? What is the goal of your religious faith?
Yeah, this is in, I mean, I think Ford is maybe more rightly connected to kind of populist language in that era. He really, I mean, he says socialists are people who don't work. And so the idea here is that what distinguishes his ideas from socialism is this labor component, is work. But I found myself surprised sometimes when reading Ford's materials because he is a huge critic of a particular kind of capitalism, a finance capitalism that he understands himself as standing against. And this comes out really directly in his battles with the Dodge brothers, who were early investors in the Ford Motor Company. And they got into a significant legal battle because Ford refused to issue dividends. And he was reinvesting funds in the company. He was raising wages and he was lowering prices, but he was not issuing dividends. And they take him to court for this. And the court basically says, you have to issue dividends. The purpose of a business is to raise money for its stockholders. Well, Ford gets furious about this. He says that's not the purpose of a business. Now, we can read those statements and should read those statements with some skepticism. This is also a kind of court of public opinion marketing ploy. And it is a philosophy of business that he understands himself to be enacting, a kind of producerism that is going to stand in contrast to finance capitalism, or what he uses, and here he's really using anti-Semitic slurs against the Dodge brothers, but referring to them as kind of non-working stockholders. He refers to them as parasites, people who don't want to labor for their wealth and want it to be handed to them. And I was surprised by this kind of critique of finance capitalism, as I was reading. One of the things I think can be, well, it was tough as a writer to write through in this chapter. And this is the chapter kind of on service. Ford wants to re-insist on a kind of industrial producerism against this kind of finance capital. And in the process, gives us a critique of this form of capitalism, right? And so then I find myself trying to think through, how does one critique Ford's critique of capitalism without slipping into a kind of neoliberalism that, well, that I don't want to do. And I think that question is one that the Ford question brings up for historians.
It's such a big, chewy, complicated subject. How did you come to this as the topic first for your dissertation and then, expanded into this book?
Yeah, there's so many ways to answer that question. How does anybody find anything? So one answer to that question is about a documentary encounter. I'm a historian. I work in archives, and I was working on an exhibit for a faculty member I was working with at the time, and I found this kind of document. It was from the 19. It was an article from a newspaper about the 1939 World's Fair. And it had an image of like a robot kind of guy standing holding like power lines, like very big guy. And he was, and he, and the headline said, "Machines as Ministers to Man" by Henry Ford. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, and that, so that was kind of, that kind of piqued my interest. So that's one, there's one way that like it was kind of this documentary encounter, and I kept coming across Ford. I was doing other research and I just kept running across him and realizing that like you couldn't get away from him in this period, even though the religious histories I was reading, he's nowhere in them. Right? And so there was this kind of huge presence and notable absence, and trying to recognize that. So that's one way. The other way is just maybe like more biographical. I was an undergrad in, when I was undergrad, I was an econ major, and then I changed and moved into the study of religion, and people are often surprised by that. And I didn't experience that as a major change. And maybe this book tries to help explain why.
Yeah. I want to get to some audience questions in a couple of minutes. I just want to remind folks that are watching along with us online that if you do have questions, please type them into the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen, and we'll read them out. I wanted to ask about your research. So what were some of your best sources? Where were some of the places that you went to find these anecdotes, these incredibly vivid stories in your book?
So the majority of the archives that I work with are Ford's personal papers, personal and family papers, and corporate archives, all of which are held together in one larger archive called it's at the Benson Ford Research Center at the Henry Ford, which is an entity that is both an industrial museum and a kind of old-timey village that also holds these archives. And so I spent most of my time in those papers, and it's part of the reason that differentiating Henry Ford the man and Ford Motor Company the brand, I think is really, honestly, I think it's close to impossible, and we should recognize as much because they're held in common. So a lot of the material I spent was with those. And some of the, you know, surprising things was just I had no idea how extensive Ford's metaphysical religious practices really were. A huge reader into New Thought. New Thought movement is this late 19th, early 20th century kind of movement where the idea is that sometimes it's called like mind power or mind cure, gets kind of connected with Christian Science earlier. But the idea here is it later becomes rebranded as what we now think of as positive thinking. Or if for those more TikTok generation, like the ideas about manifesting come from New Thought. So I had no idea that Ford was so profoundly connected to New Thought. So some of this material was incredibly eye-opening to me. If I could do it again, I would spend a lot more time in the labor archives at Wayne State in particular. It has really strong labor archives there. But there have been a lot of labor histories of Ford. Stephen Meyer's book, The $5 Day, is beautiful. It's been around for years and years, but it's a beautiful book and a really important one. And there's many other people who have studied and really dug into the labor archives. But I wonder how that could like shift things. And that would be, if I could do it again, that would be more fun to do. Yeah.
We're going to take a few questions. All I ask is that you, for the benefit of folks who are watching online, that you just wait until I bring the microphone around.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this. I have a question and a backup question. The first depends on, have you watched Severance?
I have.
Okay. So I'm going to go with this one.
Okay.
Do you see any similarities between how Keir is portrayed in the show and how Ford viewed himself?
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's such a good question. Okay, so I don't know. I mean, the mythology that gets created around these industrial or corporate figures, I think is really significant. And we see it with Ford too. I really understand Henry Ford as much a kind of brand or really kind of industrial product as the motor cars coming off his line. He too is a brand that is being made by the Ford Motor Company. It's part of the reason that this book subtitle has the Ford Motor Company and not Henry Ford. I really try to think about Ford as an industrial product. So I think you're right. That connection makes so much sense. I will also just say that it also becomes a kind of, I want to say like more grassroots thing. The archives of Ford that are at the Henry Ford, the archive, include all of this material that people around the country and world would send him that have him, Henry Ford, images of him. So like people like did like knitting. They have yarn punch rugs that are his visage, or like kind of jewel jar, or what do they call those things where there's like images inside and then stuff around them, diorama kind of things that would be of him in it. So there was these kinds of, I would say, almost kind of devotional artifacts, kind of votive materials that people would send. So, you know, it's not, it's not only a corporate product. It's also one that then people take up and own, which is, well, it troubles me. Thank you. What a cool question.
Hi. This might be a little bit of a rambling question because I'm sort of trying to make sense of a bunch of ideas.
Yeah.
But thank you. But what you said about the idea of engineers as remaking the world really stood out to me on like a global scale. And you also mentioned that Ford factories were on a bunch, like six continents. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about if there's any legacy of Ford in, or Ford's influence in sort of the like global spread of industrialism as a form of technological like extractivism and like colonization of specific areas, and what you thought about that based on your research about Ford.
Yes. So there's been great work on this. I'll say Elizabeth Esk's book called The Assembly Line and the Color Line is an excellent book for this. And she looks at many different sites across the globe, and Ford's kind of racial capitalism in each of those places. So I really strong recommend for that. I will also just say, you know, other people have written about this. There's a great book called Fordlandia that I would recommend. I talk some about this too. And one thing that, you know, Ford does is not just, you know, it is kind of doing this kind of franchise colonialism where you sort of extract resources for the metropole, right? But is also eager to export forms of Americanism in these sites. So, you know, notably, this happens in the plantations that Ford starts in Brazil and sort of tries to export this form of Americanism that he is, that looks a lot like the form of Americanism he tries to kind of memorialize in his Greenfield Village. That's the old-timey village in Dearborn, which you can still visit if you're interested. I'm not a paid advertisement, but you could go and see this, you could go see it, this form of Americanism, right? And this gets kind of reproduced in these plantation economies in Brazil. Ford also does this in a plantation he establishes in Georgia, just outside of Savannah, much lesser known, but it's Richmond Hill area. Richmond Hill is established as a Ford plantation that gets the name from Ford's plantation home, which he names Richmond Hill, and then the entire community adopts that name, and it still exists, Richmond Hill. So, you know, this kind of like extractive project that certainly is happening is also one that he's then exporting particular kinds of Americanism, both culturally and, of course, industrially, in, you know, his assembly plants all over the world.
Hi. I like that you spoke on the importance of manifestation and how he inflected on working for your riches and, you know, try to encourage the parasites, quote unquote, to, you know, not be lazy. I wanted to know, do you think back in the day, did he influence the workers and people around him of manifestation? And how do you think he viewed manifestation today in today's society?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, how much Ford engaged in, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better word, kind of the missionary impulse of New Thought, I want to moderate a little, but what I can say is Ford, I mentioned the imprints that he is sort of publishing. One of the things that Ford does is it has a corporate imprint that it's, you know, printing things for its own workers, right? magazines and other things. One of the things that I found that I did not know until I went into the archives was that Ford had a very close relationship to the Unity School of Christianity, which is a institutionalized version of New Thought, comes kind of out of the late 19th and early 20th century. And Ford is drawn to the Unity School of Christianity largely because, well, it seems like partly because he's interested in the way that they think about reincarnation. And he also asks for prayers of affirmation from Silent Unity, which is their prayer ministry. And so he asks for prayers of affirmation, both for himself and his corporate executives, and for his son, who was undergoing some very intense medical challenges, and then ultimately dies from cancer. And Ford is asking for these prayers of affirmation to help heal Edsel Ford, his son. And in the process of this kind of correspondence, Ford Motor Company also reprints some of the materials from the Unity School of Christianity, some of their pamphlets on their corporate imprint. I don't know how widely they were distributed, but I know that they were reprinted as corporate imprints for internal circulation. So that tells me, that gives me evidence to think that Ford is interested in helping other people encounter these ideas. I also know that, so he engages in a very lengthy conversation with Ralph Waldo Trine, who is a best-selling author of New Thought materials. He wrote this very famous book, In Tune with the Infinite. And Ford has many of his books on his shelf. And in the conversation with Trine, Ford talks about having lots and lots of his books and sharing them with people, giving them to other people. So clearly he was also trying to sort of share this with other people, more prominent people usually. So I don't know how much the workers get that kind of thing, but yeah.
Yeah. All right, we've got time for one more question. No pressure.
This is actually quite a direct follow-up to the previous question, but I'm curious, given the scope, I've learned a lot more now about the scope of his role, Ford's role in English education and media, and I'm curious, through your research, have you found any grand differences between how these ideas are being communicated within the company to the workers he's trying to pull into this vision versus the general public who he's just trying to get to, you know, purchase his products, and kind of how, yeah, what those differences might be, and in general, like if some of the ideas that we're seeing as more negative or controversial were filtered out to the general public in such a way that they weren't inside the company?
So my first thought was, part of Fordism is to the idea that the worker is also your consumer, and that they should be able to purchase the thing they're making. And so, and a lot of times basically he's saying, like, if you pay your workers poorly, then you lose consumers. And so the difference between the worker and the consumer there is purposefully connected, actually, for Ford. So that the rhetoric to the consumer is also to the worker. So that was my first thought. But it's true that, you know, public promotional materials are emphasizing, like, you know, how much we care for our laborers and how we're partnering with you. And yet, you know, one of the scenes that opens the second chapter really talks about how they promoted these ideas of the $5 day, but then thousands of workers showed up outside the plant, and then nobody was getting jobs. And they are freezing, it's January, and they're standing out there trying to get jobs. And then the Dearborn police come over and weaponize water against these job seekers. And then there becomes a kind of uprising, and they're throwing things at the Ford plant, right? But we don't see that. in Ford's promotional materials. We don't see that Ford workers developed what comes to be known as Forditis, which is a kind of repetitive motion disorder that gets named that, right? People aren't really talking, like Ford's not talking about that in the public, or the development of the Ford whisper, a kind of covert way of communicating with your fellow worker without taking your eyes off the line. All right, so these kinds of, like, we don't get the glimpses of that in the promotional materials. And I do think that's what a different archival look might give us a more clear vision of. And certainly labor historians have shown us some of these. Part of what is notable is that people kept coming back day after day for these jobs, even though they were not good jobs, right? They were painful jobs. Again, I think the question of what we've come to consent to gives me real pause.
Well, thank you for this incredible, enlightening, and nuanced conversation. And thank you all for coming out here tonight. If you'd like to purchase your copy of Assembling Religion, you can do that up at our front desk. And Dr. Kurtz will sign it for you here tonight. But before we get to that, if you would all join me in giving her a round of applause and thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.